The news of these Allied landings on the north coast of France has given the war its most drastic and sudden change since the Germans invaded Russia. Up to less than 12 hours ago, the Russians and the Russians alone had engaged and defeated millions of German troops in vast land battles. Our North African and Italian campaigns had diverted some German strength from Russia, so had our preparation for invasion from the West. The fall of Mussolini in July and the fall of Rome day before yesterday kept German prestige hard throughout Europe. But until Anglo-American troops began to land in force in the West, it was toward the Russians that the Germans looked with fear, and it was toward the Russians that the people of the occupied countries looked with hope. Our landings have started to change all that, and the better and faster our campaign in the West develops, the more rapidly British and American prestige will grow in Western Europe. These landings differ from the invasion of Italy in at least two important respects. First, they show that Britain and the United States have developed first-rate military power on land, as well as in the air and on the sea. We're now able to come to grips with the Germans in their own element, that's land fighting, having already mastered our two elements, the air and the sea. The campaign in Italy amounted to little more than a dress rehearsal compared with the scale of the present attack. Then, in the second place, these landings in France represent our first attempt at real liberation as compared with invasion. Although the Italian people had little liking for Mussolini and nothing but hatred for the Germans, the French people went into the war against the Germans and have lived under German domination for the past 4 years. Just as the landings in Europe will demonstrate the military power and skill of Britain and America, so these same landings will demonstrate the popular following and the fighting power that the underground resistance movement has developed in France and perhaps in other countries of Western Europe, too. For these other countries have also received notification that the liberation has begun. At the moment, though, General de Gaulle has become the key figure in the whole European resistance movement. That's because the first landings have occurred in France, and because General de Gaulle has no rival as a leader of French resistance. But it may be some time before we know how strong the French resistance movement proves, and how much General de Gaulle himself can deliver. Raymond Daniel cabled a dispatch from London. This dispatch warned the American people not to expect too much of the French resistance movement. It pointed out the great difficulties under which the French must operate. The American decision to withhold full diplomatic recognition from General de Gaulle and the French committee is therefore being put to its first practical test. And if the resistance movement does not live up to the hopes that some of us have placed in it, there may be a temptation to blame that on General de Gaulle, rather than on the French situation as a whole. If, however, the French resistance movement does prove effective, then General de Gaulle and his French committee will have scored a double triumph. They will have prevailed not only against the opposition of the Germans, but against the doubts and hesitations of President Roosevelt and our State Department. The people of the other occupied countries, with their exile and their exile leaders, will also follow events in France with passionate life and death interest. They'll see first how strong we are. Then they'll see how much authority an exiled leader carries. And if General de Gaulle cannot rally the French people around him with all his contacts in the French underground, then the exiled leaders of Belgium and Holland, and perhaps of Norway, too, may have reason to believe that from now on the leaders of the resistance struggle will be found inside Europe and nowhere else. The Russians will also watch the course of the invasion with just as much interest as we are watching it over here. Perhaps even with more interest, and this is why. Ever since the Germans invaded their country, nearly 3 years ago, the Russians have been clamoring for a second front in the West. During these 3 years, they've had about one-third of their richest territories invaded and laid waste. Nearly one-third of the Russian people have been enslaved at one time or another by the Germans. For 3 years, the Russians have been living for this day of liberation, because they've always believed that only large-scale military operations in the West can take enough German divisions off their necks for them to be able to hit back with decisive strength and really smash the German war machine. This Russian demand for a second front in the West is impossible to reconcile with the fears that some people have that Russia hopes and plans to dominate the whole European continent. Quite the opposite. Only by large-scale military operations in the West can the Anglo-American powers hope to exercise political influence over Western Europe. And the Russians are realistic enough to understand this. They'll gladly exchange a little loss of their influence, whatever it may be, in Western Europe, for military assistance from us in their task of beating the main body of the German army, which, remember, is still drawn up on the Eastern Front. If today is a bright day for the Russians, it's a dark day for the Germans. The last German hope of making a separate peace with the Russians on the one hand or the Anglo-Americans on the other has now gone up the spout. Both the Russians and the Anglo-American powers are now far too deeply committed to their present strategy. They have too much to win by keeping it up, too much to lose by abandoning it. Nevertheless, we can expect to hear plenty of German propaganda that will continue to try to stir up suspicion and division between the Anglo-Americans and the Russians. The Germans are now under pressure from east, south, and west. They have a three-front war on their hands, and they'll fight this war with political as well as military weapons in the hope that somehow, somewhere, one of these offensives can be called off. And the Japanese are going to watch with deep concern what's happening in Europe right now. If the Anglo-Soviet-American coalition comes through its present test in Europe, then the Japanese will have good reason to fear trouble for themselves later in Asia. But any split between the Anglo-Americans and the Russians would redound only to the benefit of Japan. That's why the combined liberation of Europe means bad news for Tokyo. Finally, there's the American aspect of today's great happenings. The United States now stands at the peak of its military, of its economic, of its political, and of its moral power in the world. Never in the history of our country has our power of every sort, counted for so much as it does today. More than 150 years of American history lie behind the unexampled effort that this country is now making all over the world, not only in Western Europe, but in Italy, in the South Pacific, in Asia, on the seaways and skyways of the world, and right here at home, in our factories and on our farms. We're throwing everything we've got this summer into the greatest military operation of all time. But it's much more than a military operation. The fate of the whole world is involved. And in that fate, the United States has the decisive role to play.